Learn More Truth podcast. Perspectives, topics, points of view from the conscious Moorish American standpoint. Posting weekly content. Be sure you listen, like, and support where you can. I no longer call myself black. I'm looking increasingly into Moorish science. The foundation of it happens to involve civics and law. So I'm thinking, what could be wrong with it? Seems to me that it makes sense. But in recent years, I've started to gradually get into it and learn more about it. I only figure I'd share the experience because there's others that were probably like me. They're mystified about this movement. They're mystified about the man that they call a prophet, Noble Drew Ali, the Moorish Science Temple of America. It's only after working a career and amassing life experiences that I've come to realize that I'm not in my proper standing in certain respects related to our positionality in society and being confined within a specific establishment's construct. I'm not black, I'm not Negro, I'm not colored, and I'm definitely not a person of color because none of those titles, well, they're just titles. They're not aligned or associated with nationhood or belonging to a specific nationality. It's only when you dig deeper you come to understand that there's a contrivance behind all of it, but we won't get into that today. I'm your host, Bobby Day, just giving you some basic background from my experience along my journey of Moorish consciousness. We're standing the U.S. Constitution from a Moorish perspective. Mike, just to give y'all some background, Brother Michael and I had a discussion earlier, and I asked him some questions with regard to our standing in the Constitution, whether or not it applies to us. I asked him some very pointed questions. I needed to clear up some misconceptions in my head because I'm actually getting ready to do a presentation with someone that's a Second Amendment rights advocate. And with the change of the guard here, that's becoming even more of a concern for people that are advocates for 2A, Second Amendment rights. So I just wanted to kind of touch bases on that. And you had some insight which would offer me an increased amount of clarity. So go ahead, Michael.
To start off, the Constitution, let's put it in perspective based on, where the Constitution's within nations, where they stand. Essentially, a constitution is pretty much a guideline for what and what cannot be done generally, in each nation. But then what you have, something that trumps that, is called a treaty. And the treaty generally is, it's a pact between nations, in a nutshell, it's a pact between nations. When you're dealing with treaties and you're dealing with constitutions, two really have to kind of be in unison with one another. They can't be conflicting, but most people are really only given one or the other, for the most part. For example, you take, us Americans, us true Americans here, we really, really weren't really privy of treaties and really what that really entails. And, we might have heard of the word and stuff, but we never dug in, to really see the secrecy behind that and really, really who it really applies to. Now, the Constitution, in terms of the Constitution was, it's subordinate to the treaty. Nonetheless, okay, the treaty activates the Constitution when you're dealing with the United States. And this is why. Obviously, the treaty was pretty much in agreement. And generally, all treaties really, really dealing with the whole concept of import, export, and goods and services when you're dealing with trade and commerce. And, it's dealing with, basically the tax and the treaty benefits that apply to that treaty, pact between whatever nation, whomever. The Constitution, okay, there's two constitutions. As we know, the United States was incorporated in 1871. And, as a result of that, that was post the Civil War. That was pretty much when the coup had took over in its entirety. The Moors had lost, their nationality, and they became denationalized in 1774, as Noble Drew Ali, taught us. But post 1774, that didn't mean that had happened, throughout the whole entire Moroccan or Moorish Empire at that present time. It was constant invasions, Punic Wars, a lot of invasions and stuff that was going on between the Moors and the Europeans, which led up to those agreements and contracts. And just to be clear too, whenever you're talking about a constitution, whenever you're talking about a treaty, it's no different than when you're going in and signing an application, when you're dealing with the public, when you're dealing with the courts, when you're dealing with your job. It's all based on contractual agreements. And in the law, in the eyes of law, contracts are dynamic. And what that means is just what it means. It means it's dynamic. It means that it can be amended. It can be, and that's based on just a universal law. Birthright, as a human, we have the, innate qualities and abilities to restructure, revamp, and, get back on track with the task. So contracts are dynamic. So now the problem with and having that, how the three correlate, which they're all contracts, but how the three, you know, play, you know, a part in our everyday lives is essentially is how we contract. It's how we contract. Because now we may have been born, you know, to a certain nation. We may have been, taught, you know, that we were this or we were that. But now what really applies and what is your political and social status in terms of where you contract? Because now when you're dealing with the Moors, a.k.a. Black, Negro and Coloreds, we contracted to be a status, to be subpar of a human being, to say the least, as they say, 3/5 of a human being, 3/5 of a man. We was pretty much considered as inhumane. We were considered everything undesirable. So we contracted in present day. OK, we contracted to be these particular titles in particular, you know, and to be put in a certain status where we are, where, like I said, we are deemed undesirable and not amongst, you know, the family of nations. But now prior to that, like I mentioned earlier, there were wars, you know, there was constant wars that were going on and which caused for these treaties and caused for these constitutions to be put in play. The treaty, as we know, which was enacted in 1786, 1787. Now that happened really, really just like just before the Constitution, because the Constitution was enacted in 1789. Now, why did that happen? Why did the Constitution have to come forth? Well, because they had to reconvene because there was constant struggles and issues going on between Moors and the European Christian nations, you know, and if you really look back and go into, you know, congressional records and stuff, you will see, history will show you that a lot of us Moors were doing things that were very condemning to, you know, our Albion counterpart. We were doing things, you know, that were really, really, really wasn't too kosher to people like. And when you want to talk about, you know, humanitarian deeds, we were the most pleasant people, you know, when it came to our relationship status with, you know, the Europeans. So, you know, nature has a just law, you know, you reap what you sow. And we did that. That's where we are now. But now when you look at it, when you go into from the 17th century, 18th century, when you look at it, it was always constant resets that took place. And why? Because it went from actual physical warfare to keep our people in involuntary servitude. Okay, let me say, no, it went from physical warfare to keep our people in slavery and bondage to psychological warfare to keep us in involuntary servitude. Now, both of them are kind of one and the same. You can use them synonymously, but they're a slight bit different because obviously one is against your will, okay, directly, and the other one is deals with involuntary servitude, deals more with mental and psychological warfare. Now, this is where the contraction part comes into play, and I'm going to go and dig deep into that so that everyone has an overstanding, you know, by showing you Constitution precedents and also showing you where it is in the federal statutes to show you where we have actually been contracting and really giving our birthrights away. And not to say that everything would work out to our benefit in its entirety, but in the least, we would now have a level playing field to pretty much square up and have some type of defense, because it would be seen, okay, and overseen within their system of things that we are now expressing a level of competency, which we haven't been doing. So did you have a particular area or question that pertained to the Constitution, or do you want me to just go in and explain some statutes and stuff that tie into the Constitution?
Well, you know, this is your time, man. And, you know, I've taken plenty of it because of what the glitches. But listen, I'm mainly standpoint of the Second Amendment being the issue. And what I have been mentioning is that the Constitution doesn't necessarily apply to us. But then I'm seeing groups of Moors that are establishing militias and stuff like that. And it's not unlawful, actually, to actually form a militia. It's not unconstitutional to do that. But what I'm saying is I just wanted to get an increased understanding of that, because I'm seeing the advocacy for such in terms of, you know, not necessarily forming militias, but you know, people that are of our ethnicity and that are of our shared background. And, you know, they're saying, you know, they're Second Amendment advocates. And that was kind of like what motivated me to hit you up and Brother Dale about it. And in so doing, you wanted to expound on the Constitution. So I'm great with that, because it furthers my personal understanding. And then I'm able to be on better footing myself and able to share the information, accurate information at that.
Okay.
So if you could work your way through the way you feel comfortable, brother, I'm fine. And this is going to make its way to our normal Wednesday group anyway. This is good information.
Right. Okay. Well, let me give you, you know, say particular articles that actually prove, you know, that the Moors, you know, had involvement in creating this Constitution. First and foremost, let me say this. The Constitution is built off of Muslim law. Now, Barack Obama said that. Barack Obama had actually mentioned that the Constitution is based on Muslim law. Now, Muslim law, when you think of Muslim, you have to go back to understand what does Muslim mean? Muslim, all Muslim means is of flesh and bones. So that would mean that we as human beings are all flesh and bones. So Muslim means is of flesh and bones. Okay, so you guys can do this. This is one, you know, same prerequisite for you guys to actually go looking. Barack Obama, he is the one who said that when he did that speech in Cairo, Egypt, back in 2014. Now I want you guys to pay attention to timelines, because post that, okay, speech that he did in Cairo, Egypt, which is the capital of the Moroccan Empire. When I say Moroccan Empire, that consists of North, Central, and South America. Okay, so that's Northwest and South. You know, it's Northwest and Southwest of Mexico. That is the Moroccan Empire. Now, remember, everything belongs to the Moors, but that's a little bit more in detail. You could find that, you know, Georgia House Resolution, where it stipulates that the Moors are the mothers and fathers of the human family. But again, that's, we don't want to stray off the topic. Tune into our lives every Wednesday, and we always cross-reference that often. Now, when he was doing that speech in Cairo, Egypt, all purpose for the capital of the Moroccan Empire, he had mentioned that United States Constitution is built off of Muslim law. Now, when you understand, you know, who are the mothers and fathers of the human family, who are the original men, you know, that pretty much birthed all these nations, it would be the Moorish people in present day known as the Moroccan people. So it's built off of our law. It's built off our law. Barack Obama also mentioned that it was Islam that gave Europe its renaissance. So here it is. You have people in political positions of great status, okay, who are giving and paying homage to the Moorish people. Although he spoke in code, he left it, you know, pretty straightforward. You know, for only thing you have to do is really study, you know, to really, really find out and discover that he's talking about us Moors. But as he does, because he's a politician, he has to speak in code, but it's also for security purposes. We have to understand that. Now, Noble Drew Ali said that we are part and parcel of the United States. He didn't say we're United States citizens, but he said we are part and parcel. Now, why would he say that? Now, this is going to correlate to the question at hand. We're talking about, does the Constitution apply to Moors? Well, absolutely. Let's start article by article. If you go to Article 1, Section 2, right? When it starts talking about, it mentions who, okay, can be taxed. And it actually says that Indians are not to be taxed. Now, we know that the term Indian was replacing Moors. Why? So that they can disguise the fact, okay, of who these people are that Christopher Columbus, okay, claimed to have discovered when he came here. But as he so eloquently explained, when he went back to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, he explained to them the Berber people there, the people of with the bronze complexion are there. When you talk about the people with the woolly hair, you know, straight and the flat noses and golden brown skin, he was talking about the Moors. So that was just really, really a gimmick. And that was really a ploy that we learned in the public school curriculum to kind of get us, yes, just raising questions. But it's kind of like, you know, a tantalizing event, you know, to kind of wave, you know, saying who you really are and your legacy and really kind of throw it in your face that it's been taken from you, you know, for whatever reason, or for, you know, just like the nana nana poo poo game. Article 1, you know, mentions Indians are not to be taxed. So if Indians are not supposed to be taxed, okay, we know present day through our study, if you're a Moor, you would know that the Indian is referred to in modern day, that's is referred to the Moor. And from a lawful standpoint, then you would know that obviously Moors had to be present to make that engagement possible. That's number one. Number two, if you go to Article 1, Section 9, it talks about titles of nobility. Titles of nobility are condemned pursuant to the Constitution of the United States. No person is supposed to be wearing any title of nobility. But if you look to present day, we have politicians, senators, governors, you know, mayors, presidents. They are in positions of power and influence, okay? Article 1, Section 10, where it says that no state shall make anything but gold and silver as a medium of exchange for all debts, and no titles of nobility shall be given. But what happened was, these people, post that Constitution, as they've always been doing, declared and went to war with the Moors, your ancestors, our ancestors, and gradually, they built their power. They built their power, and they built their influence, and overall, and they instilled their governments, okay? Their government and their systems of things upon our people. And it was really post the Civil War when our people really, really became denationalized and really, like, became oblivious to who we were in our history as a people. The next proof is, well, when you look at Article 6, the Supremacy Clause, where it starts talking about the treaties. Now, why is the treaties put there in the Supremacy Clause? Well, because it's the supreme law of the land. Pursuant to Article 6, those people known as Moors are the supreme lawgivers. And actually, what it says in Article 6 is that it says that no contract or no other engagement shall be entered into after this Constitution, and this Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land. It didn't say it, you know, the way I said it verbatim, but it said it to that effect. It said it to that directness. Article 6 was the Supremacy Clause. So the fact that we are even asking the question of does it pertain, how can it be, when Article 6 is the Supremacy Clause, which would mean that that's the most supreme clause out of all the articles. And it talks about the treaties that were entered in prior to this Constitution. Now, we know that Treaty of Peace and Amnesty was presented before the Constitution. So Article 6, so you know it had to be the Moors, and this is why Noble Jirali always says invoke the Constitution. He doesn't say invoke the treaty, but the law is you're supposed, he doesn't say invoke the treaty because your intuition is supposed to tell you based on study that you are only governed under treaty law, because Noble Jirali was coming from a school of thought. Number one, he was ahead of his time, but he also was coming from a school of thought because he understood jurisprudence. He understood civics. He understood philosophy. He understood ethics. He understood international law. And he knew from that standpoint, he understood this. I'm going to tell them to enforce the Constitution is going to already invoke the treaty because the treaty is already the supreme lawgiver, okay, that activates that Constitution. Hence Article 6, Article 6 of the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause, where it says all engagements and contracts and treaties entered in prior to the engagement of this Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land. So we're supposed to know intuitively to go ahead now and invoke the Constitution. And that's also why he said we are part and parcel. So here you have the articles, you have Article 6, and then before I forget one more thing that's going to actually go hand in hand with Article 6, Article 3, which talks about foreign ambassadors and talk about the consular courts. This is what our people don't know either. Whenever we're in a custody, but it's not your fault, because I'm gonna clarify that when I start going into the statutes and stuff that sure. like verify yeah. what I'm saying. The problem is with our people is because number one, indoctrination and social engineering over years, obviously. One, and it has to do with our social and political status. You know, we have the understanding that we're United States citizens, and when most of us don't have an idea what that means, you know, being a United States citizen. First of all, United States citizen is a 14th Amendment citizen. Now, when you start looking at things at the Dred Scott case will show you, it tells you clearly that the people of African descent cannot, shall not, and will not be United States citizens. But the only thing that they didn't tell you is the reason why that they can't be United States citizens, because they are the actual true indigenous people here. So when that Supreme Court precedent came in place, they was coming from a standpoint of knowing who Dred Scott was, where he didn't even know who he was. That's why the ruling was plaintiff in error. You can't come into our courtroom wearing and bearing the names, okay? You can't bear the names, let alone bear arms. You cannot bear the names of Dred Scott, Johnson, Jones, Smith, okay, Johnson, all these names that have a stock brand that's owned by the crown. Because if you look at the Treaty of 1856, okay, between the Britain and the Moors here, these people are British subjects. And furthermore, whenever they're dealing with any type of Moor, and this is why it was important for them to denationalize us so they can assume and have absolute executive deed over our estates here. Because according to that treaty, they're supposed to contact the crown when they have any type of encounters with us. But we didn't know this stuff. So we became, you know, compelled to get involved with all type of contracts. So now it's when the cop pulls you over, when you're coming before a judge, which is the foreign ambassador, all he sees in his system and in his paperwork is saying that, listen, you were a United States citizen. And if my thoughts, you know, saying prove me right, you were a willing United States citizen because you were literate, or your mother and father was illiterate, and they pretty much surrendered your birthrights to us. So with that said, any altercations amongst foreign nations, which is expressed in Article 3 of the Constitution, you can pretty much regurgitate everything that I'm saying when you go through these articles. But Article 3 actually expresses that consular courts are supposed to be dealt with when dealing with, you know, foreign nationals. So the United States is supposed to be dealing with the consular court. That's pursuant to Article 3. So if the Constitution, so now if we backtrack and go back now, in every article, particularly Article 1, Article 3, Article 6, okay, all these articles are talking about how you're supposed to deal with the Aboriginal people. In order for that to be there, you had to have someone there to make sure that there was an insurance policy. Because that would be the assurance/insurance policy that the indigenous people here in this landmass would have, the Republican form of government based on the relationships. We know it as the Republic, okay? And also so that they are the most favored nation. Article 6, all contracts, treaties, and engagements entered in prior to this contract, aka Constitution, shall be the supreme law of the land. That's what it says verbatim. So when they say that we are not a party to this, that's like an oxymoron. But I get it, and that's why I'm here with Brother Dolph on this platform to show you and break it down so you understand these different things. Now, it was just manipulated, just like the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment, if you read the Congressional Globe, the 13th Amendment was expounded upon a lot further. And it actually said, if I'm correct, I had the article, and I don't have a lot of my props here because a lot of this stuff I just got locked in my mind. But it says, actually, any enslavement of any person of the African race, the punishment is death. But we know that the Constitution was usurped after they defeated the Moors around the time of the Civil War. So they started making different modifications and stuff to that. But they understood certain principles that they had to keep in place based on balance, because they had to appease nature. And that's the underlying thing, okay, that the masses, that they know that they don't know. This is why it's important to understand your zodiac and understand the zodiac constitution and how it applies to you, because everything is based on space and time of cyclical events that can't be abrogated because it's based on law. Any questions before I proceed?
No, I turned down my mic, man, just to let you go, because I know okay. You got it all in you. And
okay.
What is your position on us being, considering ourselves as citizens? Are we or are we not citizens?
No, we're not citizens, so we can't be citizens. Remember, Dred Scott case, you know, you got to go to Dred Scott, you know, Dred Scott is the case law. First of all, you can't, okay, well, two things. Let me just assert Dred Scott to show you the case precedents from the highest court in the land. One, and also show you, you know, within law, where you can't do that. You can't be a citizen because you belong to a nation. Now, you could relinquish or you could renunciate, you know, your nationality. That's even given within the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. You have the right to relinquish, you know, your nation. And I'm going to get into that also, you know, so people, you know, say good notice, because it's important for our embassy to have these things put in place before we get our tribes and our nations in order. But what to do while we're currently dealing with the public side, we need to get our private status asserted on the public side.